everyone. Our next case is HVZ versus the United States. We will hear oral argument from three counsel. Major Bunnell, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Colonel Italis, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Castanian, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the real party in interest?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Please proceed.
Good morning. Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Mike Bunnell. With Ms. Devin Wells, Major Marilyn McCall, and I represent HVZ, the appellant in this case. Judge Olson, may I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
The core problem in this case is that the military judge and the Air Force Court, in their own respective ways, simply applied the wrong sets of rules. With respect to Issue 1, the military judge applied the disclosure rules of RCM 701 when he should have applied the production rules of RCM 703 when it came to 20 years' worth of our client's medical records. And in doing so, and this is issue number two, in doing so, he summarily refused to consider even the possibility that she might have standing on this issue. That's what this court in LRM called a blanket prohibition. This was error. Now, the Air Force Court, for its part, this is the third issue, the Air Force Court, for its part, it applied the wrong standard of review. It turned to the All Writs Act, and it lifted the three-part test, including the clear and indisputable error standard, and then it dropped it into a context where Congress had already prescribed a statutory jurisdiction for the victims to appeal. This was also error. Now, in light of these errors, we're asking this court to issue a writ of mandamus vacating the military judge's order and establishing three things as a matter of law. First, the medical records belong in 703, that victims have the right to object at the trial level when their Article 6B rights are violated, and that when it goes to appeal, that the standard of review on appeal is an abuse of discretion. Now, certainly the 600-pound gorilla in the room is the question of medical records. Are they 701 and 703? And I want to be very...
Major Bunnell, before you go down there, I'd like to raise with you the second issue that you had in regard to standing.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your brief, you raised the issue of cases and controversies, the doctrine of cases and controversies. And you seem to indicate that that doctrine by itself can create standing. In other words, as long as a person can demonstrate that there was injury, causation, and redressability of the harm, that standing alone creates standing. Is that indeed a correct characterization of your argument?
It's one of the arguments, Your Honor, yes. I think our primary argument really is just the actual language in 6B, subsection E, where it says that you have to have it, if a victim believes under, this is the enforcement under the CCAs.
Understood, but I'm basing it on your own brief where you make this argument, and I need to test the validity of that argument through this back and forth.
Please, Your Honor. Yeah, please.
I'm wondering how that position that you take in your brief is supported by Woodridge. In that case, we seem to be indicating that when it comes to cases and controversies doctrine, that what we're looking at there is actually a winnowing out of people who would not be able to have standing. So where are you finding this basis in this court's precedents or elsewhere to say that the cases and controversies doctrine would create standing?
Well, I think we would look to Chisholm and I think also Woodridge, like you said, but they're saying that the Lujan factors apply to the military context. And so the question when you go into cases and controversy is there an injury? Is there redressability? And is there redressability? And so when you look at what's going on in this case and you just apply that test, there's clearly an injury to rights. I mean, these are not only are they statutory rights to privacy, but we've got constitutional right to privacy in one's medical records, and they're being disclosed without any process.
But that's kind of the second part that you have, both here in your brief and what you're trying to get at here. Isn't the position better supported, your position, that Article 6B provides the standing and that the cases and controversies doctrine demonstrates that, in fact, in this particular case, this victim does have standing?
It's both, Your Honor, is the answer. Part of it is response to the defense's idea that, hey, look, what you have here is they don't have They don't have standing to even be involved here. The Article 6 privacy right is not even being implicated. And so we're saying, hey, look, let's say on face value that that's true. If Article 6B isn't implicated, we still have cases in controversy. If there's no statutory jurisdiction, then we still look to standing doctrine in Lujan versus Wildlife. And so in that event, yes. But to your point, Your Honor, our first and best argument is it's in the statute itself. It says that there has to be a trial court or court-martial ruling.
Understood. But with your second argument, you're looking at Lujan. I'm saying where in this court's jurisprudence are you finding cases and controversies, doctrine support your position?
Well, I think
you're talking about Article 3 courts, we're in Article 1 court. I'm asking for what you're finding as a basis for supporting your position.
Well, I don't think Woodridge is saying that we wouldn't have standing in that case, and I think Chisholm and LRM also is, again, an example of where they're going through the cases and controversy analysis and saying victims have standing. But I think the real question is if I'm understanding your question right, Your Honor, is there a jurisdictional hook through one of the substantive rights in Article 6B? And that's why we make that argument, is because that was in question. And so it's a belt and suspenders sort of answer. But yes, we have Article 6B, the statutory language saying that we have the right to appeal a court-martial ruling. But if we didn't, we still have cases in controversy. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes.
Major, is it Bunnell?
Bunnell.
Can you tell me whether or not in the record, or at least refresh my recollection, as the trial judges say, on whether or not it was disputed or litigated where the military judge should start his analysis, in 701 or 703? You know what I mean? The discovery request comes to the government requesting under 701, right, I think.
Correct, Your Honor.
Certain documents that we're now kind of referring to as Millett documents, right? And then, you know, it can't get resolved by the parties, so they come to the military judge. Now, why does the military judge start at 701? Is it only because that's what's in the discovery request, or what?
That is a great question, Your Honor, and it's a great question I want to ask the military judge. I don't think that they should apply to this. I mean, what are we dealing with? We would love to have been able to object and say, this is actually belongs in 703, but we didn't get that.
Right, you weren't there, but not you, but I mean,
yeah.
But so that issue, as far as you know, never came up between the actual parties in the trial.
Correct. In fact, that's, I think, the defense's point is what they're saying is, look, this is a dispute just between the two of us.
Hmm.
We're disagreeing on what the records are. And our position is, look, we'll look at that at face value. Let's talk about a different right, for example. If a different right was implicated, like the right to attend trial,
hmm,
that's right there in 6B. If let's say the defense or the trial counsel is posted up outside the door, victim's counsel goes to walk into the door and says, you can't come in. And the victim says, well, I have a right to attend unless you can show by clear and convincing evidence that my testimony is going to be materially altered. And trial counsel says, well, that's exactly what we think is going to happen. What is the victim supposed to do? Can't take it to the trial court. According to the Air Force, they don't have standing at the trial court to object. Can't take it to the CCA because there's no ruling. They're pointing that out and saying, this is between two parties. And I'm like, it's not between two parties when our rights are being violated.
Yeah. I'll leave you alone here in a minute. But let me back up just a tad here. is it your view that maybe, and you don't have to agree with me, but is it your view that maybe this problem has arisen about where the military judge should start his or her analysis by the fact that, first of all, I'm not beating up on our majority in Millett. It is the law of the court, and I love my brethren and sisters.
Sister, yeah.
But in Millett, we didn't...
I wasn't really, here for that.
In Millett, we didn't give any guidance on where the trial judges should start. So it sounds like to me what's happening is that, at least in your case, is that the discovery request comes in, and since Millett says this material is not privileged material, that everyone kind of, at least in your case, decided, well, it's just like every other kind of, you know, document or evidence that we're looking for that's in the possession of the government. Mm-hmm. It's like it's over, same kind of documents over at the SJA's office, over at dispersing, over at the adjutant's office, over at the CID office, that they're kind of looking at it like that. And I think your point is that, wait a minute, it's not like that stuff, right?
That's exactly our point.
In fact, in Millett, fortunately, and give me credit to the Millett majority for sure, they did suggest that this stuff might, in fact, it's not generally privileged, but it might be, right?
Right, there'd be a commingling or something like that.
Yeah, okay. So you don't have to agree with me, and I'm sorry for lecturing you, but it sounds like that's kind of what your beef is, too.
Well, our beef really is that there's an a priori, there's this an assumption that the medical records that are not privileged at the MTF are already in the physical or constructive possession of military authorities, and we take significant issue with that.
And how so? I read the briefs, and I may not be that smart. So I'm military treatment facility or medical treatment facility, U.S. pick a service name. So how is it not within the possession, custody, and control of a military authority? Or I guess let's answer the question about, then how do you define military authority? It sounds to me like you're using a very narrow definition for military authority, almost akin to prosecution. And that's not what the rule says.
Well, the rule says military authorities.
Right.
And my position is, like, at best, it might be ambiguous. But when you're talking about law, when you're talking about criminal law, just generally, when you talk about the authorities, you're talking about law and order. I mean, the plain way to read that is the MTF is going to deliver the records to the military authorities.
Correct. And there is a mechanism by which, the MTF is going to deliver the records upon subpoena or order to whomever is identified to deliver them to. But, I mean, it's all Department of Defense. So it's all on a part of the military authorities.
Well, and let's take that argument at face value. And I want to, if I can, parse it out. There's a difference between physical possession, who the military authorities are, and constructive possession. But we're just talking about physical possession right now. Assuming that's the case, and that everybody in the Department of Defense with any authority is a military authority, that means that all of their personal possessions are also in the constructive possession, custody, and control of military authorities, and virtually anything that they could access is now going to be turned over. It's already in their possession.
But that's an absurd hypothetical.
Right. I'm just saying, yeah.
We have here documents. Like, look, is it part of the military? Is the MPF, or is it part of the military or not?
It is definitely part of the military.
Okay. Are they authorities over those records? Isn't it their duty in the military to house and maintain those records?
Absolutely.
So I'm confused. If they're part of the military and they're an authority, how are they not military authorities?
Well, I would say look at this court's opinion in McPherson and Kelly and a myriad other cases where you step back. You cannot look at the language in a vacuum. At the very best, it's ambiguous. Courts use it either way.
What's ambiguous about it?
Because
military, yes. Non-military, no.
Well, let's say.
I would draw the distinction in the language in 701 to that is in 703, which says government. So there's a clear, you could argue there's a clear distinction with regards to how broad or narrow that is the difference between government versus military authorities. So I that's a friendly amendment to Judge Hardy's question.
Let me try to respond to both.
Okay.
So let's take the phrase itself at face value.
Mm-hmm.
And say, how is that applied throughout, not just the RCMs, but the MCM generally, invariably, always? That term is used to describe those that are involved in the case. Look at the language in 701D.
This is a rule about production. It's not like these documents are at DHS or in the hands of a private party. They're in the military's possession. Like, why would we not read the rule to say we treat differently things that the military has in its possession and things that it doesn't? Like, why would we subdivide military authorities into, like, well, we're going to read into this rule, some military people count and others don't, and how do we even know how to divide it?
Well, I don't think we have to. I think the MCM does that for us, because every time that phrase is used, it's using to describe those that are involved in the case. I think the language of 701D explains the dilemma very well. It says, this is the continuing duty to disclose for trial counsel. It says trial counsel has a duty to encourage military authorities and other governmental agencies involved in the case about their continuing duty. Now, who is it that trial counsel is supposed to be advising, encouraging? Is it all military authorities, the entire Department of Defense, every time they have a – that's a specific requirement that they do in every single case. Who are they supposed to be notifying? If military authorities is a broad thing, then that provision doesn't make any sense. If you look at the federal rule, the counterpart here, which is an even broader term, it's the government. Rule 16, it says in the possession, custody, and control of the government, courts have been unequivocal. That means the defense adversary, the prosecution, they wouldn't even include court probation officers or courts themselves. They're saying it has to be in law enforcement or the prosecutors. Now, this court's opinion in Stellato addresses this. It uses the phrase prosecution. Oh, Your Honor, I realize I'm out of time.
Yes. Further questions from the bench?
Yes, I do have one question, if I may. Are you asking this court to issue a writ of mandamus or to order the CCA to issue a writ of mandamus?
We think it probably is better for the CCA to do it, but half a dozen one or six of the other for us.
Well, my question is, where would we get the authority to issue the writ of mandamus other than through the All Writs Act?
I think it's a fair point, and I think the appropriate remedy then would be to give it to the CCA, to order them.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Colonel Towles?
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. Colonel Zachary Italis, I'm joined today with Colonel Matt Talcott, and together we represent the United States. Now, this case is about competing interests and rights between the accused and his right to a fair trial and to defend himself. The interest of the United States in justice and efficiency, and the interest of the victim in standing and interest in privacy. And while the services and Congress have made great strides to support victims by providing them statutory standing in certain circumstances, in this case there are three reasons why the victim does not have standing. And the first reason is that the medical records were held by military authorities. They were in the possession, custody, and control of military authorities. And being in that, they fall under 701 and not 703. And because they fall under 701, there's no standing under 703. The second reason is that there is no standing at the trial court level reading the plain language of Article 6B.
Now, how so? We've got Article 6B, and it says that a victim, such as appellant in this case, quote, has the right to be treated with fairness in regard to the victim's privacy. Now, there are few things more private in this world than an individual's mental health records. And when it comes to fairness, one of the most fundamental aspects of fairness is the opportunity to be afforded the right to be heard in a meaningful way and in a meaningful time. So, how is it that the military judge did not clearly violate the plain language of Article 6B here?
Well, I think if we separate mental health records from non-privileged records, and so there's no, under 513, there's standing, and that's clear, but under 6B, there's no standing with respect to non-privileged medical records. So if we take for a second that assumption that they're not privileged, then there is no standing for the victim to come in. And I think...
But part of the fundamental question that was being posed is whether these records would have fit under Millett, affording an opportunity for the victim to say, there's an exception here, something along those lines. It's a little bit of chicken and egg or Alice in Wonderland with the Queen saying, verdict first and or sentence first and verdict afterward. Why, under the plain language of 6B, when it says the victim has the right to be treated with fairness in regard to privacy interests, that they're not afforded the opportunity to simply be heard?
And it's because we look further down at 6B and we see what the specific enforcement mechanism is. And the enforcement mechanism for any violation of the rights articulated in 6B are to go to the CCA.
Now, that is in there. But why does the articulation that the CCA is a means of vindicating the rights of a victim mean that that is the sole means? Does it really make sense, just from a practical standpoint, that we would say, or the statute would say, you don't have the ability to do this at the trial court level, even before trial, even for the military judge to develop the record and so forth? No, your only mechanism is to go to the CCA. Where is that language in there that says the only mechanism is the CCA, as compared to Congress saying, we want to make it clear that going to the CCA is a mechanism?
So if you look and we consider the rights and privileges under 513, so there is that right and that standing under 513. But clear under Article 6B by itself, it's we can look at the plain language and we can compare it to the CVRA and we can see exactly what a trial level standing would look like, because the Congress articulated what that would look like, and it's absent from 6B. And then actually, to answer your question, it leads me to my third point.
Well, I was just going to ask, what do we do with Article 6B A4, right? There it creates a right to be reasonably heard at three specific proceedings. Is that a grant of standing, or is that something else? At least at a minimum, with respect to those three enumerated parts of the trial.
I agree with respect to those rights, with sentencing, parole, and so forth. That does grant standing. And so if you look at that too, that could be read to the exclusion of the other rights in Article 6B, because clearly it's pointed out that there is standing in certain circumstances.
And do we need to equate the right to be treated with fairness and with respect for the dignity and privacy of the victim? Does that equate to standing? Or are there things that the military judge could do that would satisfy that right that might fall short of standing? What's the government's position on that?
Exactly. I think before we had victims' counsels, we had trial counsel. And trial counsel was, you know, the liaison to the courtroom, the ally in the courtroom for the victim. And so now we've articulated this dignity and respect for privacy. It's a duty for trial counsel to be mindful of that. And it's also a duty for the military judge. Just in this case, I mean, you can look at the steps that the military judge took to protect the records, and it looks like that was definitely a consideration. He denied, you know, kind of a wholesale release of all the records. There were protective orders, and no records to date have been released to the defense. So the judge definitely considered it, but I agree that it is something less than standing at the trial court, but it does impose a responsibility.
Would the military judge, under the right to be treated with fairness and with respect, would it be within their discretion to grant a victim the opportunity to be heard at trial?
It would not. They would have to. There would have to be either statutory standing under Article 6B that they could point to, something similar to what we see under the CVRA, or they would have to meet a traditional test for standing, which I think.
So, under your approach, the victim has this right, but despite the language that's in here, there is still this very paternalistic, oh, don't worry, victim, we'll take care of you. You don't have a voice. What was happening in here in 6B didn't empower you in any way. Is that your reading of this?
To some extent.
Yes?
To some extent, it is.
So they have a right based on the plain language, but they're not going to be afforded even the opportunity to be heard in their effort to vindicate that right.
Under the plain language of 6B, it's with comparison to the CVRA.
Now, you say plain language, But where does it say they don't have a right? You're looking at it in terms of what isn't in there. We're in dangerous territory if we look at every statute and say what isn't in there means that that is what the statute means. You're not pointing to anything that says here that they don't have standing. You're looking at other things and say, it doesn't say standing here, it does in other places, therefore there's no standing here.
Yes, Your Honor, to break that down just a little bit, so it's read to the exclusion. We have under the specific hearings that are articulated where there is standing, and then we have the enforcement mechanism, and it would make sense. So by excluding that, we can look at 6B when we read the document in its entirety, and we can come to the conclusion that Congress did not intend to give the right at the trial level.
So why didn't Congress phrase this in terms of the military judge shall protect the victim's right to be treated, or the victim, the military judge shall ensure that the victim shall be treated with fairness and privacy? Why did Congress say that a victim has a right?
It is to communicate to the judge, to trial counsel, and to set the standard for the CCA and for this court. And I think one of the problems that we have with enforcement of this particular right at the trial court level is that if the trial court judge finds that this is relevant information, and I'm not saying that it's privileged under 513, then it's not redressable. Because the trial, there's no mechanism to say that even though the victim has a right to privacy, we can't say that, okay, that's offensive, it violates the right to privacy, we can't exclude that evidence. We still have to give that evidence to the accused because the accused has an interest and a right in defending him or herself. And so the problem that we run into is that it's not redressable at the trial court level. So it's not just the plain language of Article 6B, it's the end result of how far could we take this? So the military judge could listen to the information, but at the end of the day, the military judge's hands would be tied. They could say, yes, that's very private information, but it still meets the low threshold of relevance. We have to turn it over. And so it's not a redressable harm at the trial court level. And that is the third point as to why the victim in this case doesn't have standing.
Counsel, can I ask you about the standard of review? The standard of review is that the victim would have to show a clear and indisputable right to the relief being sought. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How does that standard work in these cases where we don't have any precedent and the only way these cases can get to us is on writs? I mean, doesn't it seem like there's a disconnect there? I mean, how, for example, on this particular issue, you've just been going back and forth with the judges and appellant has about whether they have a right to have standing. Certainly don't have any precedent on that point, so it would be difficult to say there's a clear and indisputable right just because there's the word fairness. But aren't we in a position now where we're never going to get any precedent if we apply the clear and indisputable right standard?
It's a high standard, and I think we have to assume that Congress used writ of mandamus for a reason. And if we look at the CVRA, they included that language, and there were six circuits that applied that standard before Congress came in and actually said that ordinary standards apply. And they made no similar change to Article 6B at the time. So I agree with Your Honor that it will be it'll be difficult to grant relief because the standard is so high, but that doesn't mean that the court can't review the issues. But it does pose a problem because another thing, it's only the rulings that are appealable to the CCA. So in the event that there's no ruling, there's no ability to appeal that issue to the CCA.
So why shouldn't we look, for instance, at LRM versus Kastenberg, where this court observed, quote, there is longstanding precedent that a holder of a privilege has a right to contest and protect the privilege. And I understand your point would be what we're dealing with is non-privileged information, but that's kind of the point that a victim would want to be heard on, is whether there's a privilege or not.
I think to the extent that we're trying to determine whether there is a privilege or not, because that is the question of whether they have standing that's pre-existing, because in that case, it would be redressable. So if there is a privilege and the information is not admissible, in that case, the military judge could look at that and very clearly say, your right to the privileged information, that won't be released to the defense. And so that's a little bit different than the facts of this case. We're looking at really medical records that are not privileged at all, that are related to injuries that the victim suffered.
In this case, the military judge, can be argued, did a very good job of trying to make sure that it was only non-privileged material. But what if you've got these other cases where what the victim wants to contest is this whole point about whether it's privileged or not? How do we draw that line when it comes to the issue of standing to contest that point? For them to say, Millett does not apply in this instance because?
I think you can look at, broadly speaking, you can look at the source of the documents. Did they come from a medical treatment facility? What clinic did they come from? Did they come from the mental health flight? And so you'll know, broadly speaking, if it's possible that a privilege applies. And if they just come from, say, the emergency room or family health or, medical care that was provided due to some sort of a trauma, then I think that we're outside of 513 and there wouldn't be standing under, the absence of the language in 6B and the inability of the military judge to redress cure this or prevent the release of that evidence. So I think to answer your question, it's we look broadly at where the information is coming from, and then we look at an assertion of rights by the victim that, yes, this is privileged information. This is information that should not be released under 513. And then that would generate standing.
But how do you get there unless the victim is afforded an opportunity to be heard?
Well, and again, we're looking at the source of the documents. Broad picture, that's how we would know. If we're asking for documents where we would expect that privileged information would come from, the mental health flight, then under those circumstances, then we would, the victim would have a right to protect the privileged information.
Counsel, I think part of what the Chief is asking is there any other mechanism? So if we were in civilian courts, right, you can move to squash a subpoena, you can intervene. There are other ways to contest the production of information. Is there any, to your knowledge, is there any other mechanism that might have been available to the victim to contest the production of these materials? Or is the only possible opportunity they had was in front of the military judge in this proceeding, where they did file, right? They did file a written objection. Is that the only way that they could have fought this?
The other way they could address it with trial counsel. Is before there was victims' counsel, trial counsel was the liaison in the courtroom, and really that's their limitation, because if we look at 6B, it doesn't give them the right to raise the issue at the trial court level. So they're limited to trial counsel and their victims' counsel, but to necessarily file a motion, they wouldn't be able to do that under the current state of the law, And it's different from the CVRA, and it clearly is. Some of the briefs equate them and say that we should look at one to read the other, and we do to a certain point, but what we can clearly tell is that they're different, and Congress is treating the Article 6B differently. And whether that's for expediency, because of the way that we convene our courts, the federal district courts are standing courts where they have the capacity and the judges to hear things at the trial level, whereas military courts are convened and we fly witnesses in and they last for, 5 or 6 days for a long one. And that might be the reason, but we don't specifically know why. We can speculate as to why they're different, but they're clearly different statutes and different rights that apply to victims.
Is it possible here that we have a problem because the military judge essentially sandbagged the victim? They allowed them to file a written objection and then didn't rule on whether or not or decide whether or not he was going to accept it or review it or include it in his analysis until after he made his decision. Is it possible there were other avenues of relief that were quashed because of the way that that process worked its way out?
Well, I certainly think that the military judge was aware of the concerns that the victim had in this case. I mean, the victim did file the motion, but then, you know, looking at the plain language and the precedent that we have, there's the military judge's hands were tied. It's not the military judge is not in a position to just grant standing. It's not a kind of a discretionary thing. They only have you either meet the test or it's a statutory right. So I do think that those things were communicated to the military judge, and he obviously knew that there was issues with the release of the records, and that might be what led to the generation of some of his protective measures that he took with respect to the record.
Wouldn't the military judge have the discretion to just decide on his own, I'm going to, because of Millett and how they talked about these kind of evidence, couldn't the military judge have simply decided on his or his own that I'm going to start in 703 and not 701? Why couldn't he have done that?
Well, the plain language of 701 is actually pretty strong, and the provision that the military judge decided it under, it talks about records under the possession and control of military authorities, and it actually references, you know, not necessarily medical, but the results of physical and mental examinations. And so,
right, but I mean, maybe you don't agree with me, but under 701G, the military judge is charged with being responsible for making the decisions to properly regulate discovery in a case. And so after Millett, the military judges are presented with this situation where Millett has said that certain, and I understand your time is, Millett has indicated that certain information is presumptively not privileged, but it could be. And so with that in the mind of the military judge, why couldn't he use his authority under 701G and decide, ha, I'm going to, out of an abundance of caution and in my discretion, I'm going to start over in 703 and resolve this issue and see where we end up. In other words, the greater, affording the greater protection of a potential privilege holder than not.
Your Honor, may I?
Please respond.
So he doesn't have to move to 703. And I think that 701G...
Well, I'm saying he doesn't have to, but can he?
No, because 703 specifically applies to documents outside of the government. But the military judge could do something similar to what you're talking about. The military judge could take additional measures if there's a concern for that. But that still doesn't place us under 703. But if there's this concern for privileged information, the military judge could fashion a sort of a remedy to address that situation.
You're saying he can't?
He can.
No, I mean, you said you could not refer, use 703. I mean, I understand that the thrust in 703 is for information that's in the hands of the government, or not in possession of the government, but why couldn't the military judge just use a broad approach to this? He's not forbidden from doing that.
And he just wouldn't characterize it as under 703, Your Honor. It would be. I agree with your assessment. Absolutely.
That's true. I guess that's what I'm saying. Is that why couldn't he just do that? And just saying he didn't have to say 703. He's saying I'm going to resolve this discovery matter in an appropriate manner to protect a potential privilege holder. I apologize for going over, Chief.
Perfectly fine.
And, Your Honor, largely I agree that the military judge could have done something similar to that if he was concerned with privileged information.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Colonel Attals. Captain Castanian.
Thank you, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Captain Samantha Castanian, and I, along with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Marinos, represent the real party in interest, Technical Sergeant Michael Fuel, in today's case. Appellant's construction of Article 6B(a)(9) is inconsistent with the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the rules for courts-martial, and any legislative history. It upends the discovery process while simultaneously granting a named victim a broader right to an interlocutory appeal than even that of the United States government. This court should find at minimum that Article 6B A9 does not include a basis for a named victim to intervene on a discovery ruling. As to the other certified issues before this court, the military judge did not clearly and indisputably err, which is the correct standard, when he found that appellant's medical records maintained at a military treatment facility were under the control of military authorities and thus governed by RCM 701. Nor did he err when he found that appellant did not have standing at trial to contest a discovery dispute between the parties in this case.
Now, on page 14 of your brief, you write, quote, limiting the meaning of Article 6BA9 UCMJ ensures named victims do not frivolously intervene on issues solely between the parties. So let's break that down a little bit. So in your view, the disclosure of a victim's mental health records is an issue that is solely between the accused and the government. The victim whose mental health records they are has no interest there in having them publicly disclosed.
Your Honor, I push back on a few of those premises. First, this is unprivileged matters. This is specifically what we are calling Millett matters, such that they are discoverable and not governed by 513. So any sort of privilege within is inapplicable. Second, it's not publicly disclosed. This is information that the military judge has thoroughly and thoughtfully reviewed in order to determine that it meets the proper standard for disclosure. This is comparable to any other discovery right to discovery that defense has for these records. It does not suddenly give a basis for any named victim to come in and say, no, defense, you should not have access to these records. There is an interest, but Congress has not provided for any named victim to intervene on that matter unless it falls under 513 or RCM 703. There can be a...
What about, as the point was belabored on my part with Colonel Attalas, this whole point of 6BA9 talks about the fact that the victim has a right here. Where do you find in there this plain language that says they don't have the ability to be heard on that issue?
Your Honor, for three primary reasons, and it's all about how Article 6BA9 is interpreted. So first, in order to understand what Article 6BA9 means, it still needs to be harmonized with the rest of Article 6B and Article 46. Second, just by the plain language of the rules for courts martial, particularly RCM 701 and RCM 703 that come from Article 46, and then taken to its logical conclusion, appellant's construction of Article 6BA9 is limitless. We don't talk about this much in our brief, but that's the reality of what it is. This goes back to concepts that have already been brought up. Where is the right to intervene on an abatement issue? Where are these principles that are not clearly expressed by Congress that suddenly fall under the right to be treated with fairness and with respect for the named victim's dignity and privacy? They're not embedded there. And if taken to its logical conclusion, Article 6BA9 essentially consumes the rest of Article 6B. It renders the entire statute surplusage. And this goes back to one of Your Honor's questions about standing as well. If we're reading in standing to Article 6BA9, it's taking power from Article 6B4 and the enforcement mechanism that's articulated in Article 6BE. Congress has written this law, and it is not this court's job to interpret extra textual considerations when the word of the law is clear.
How is it clear? Again, go back to what I was discussing with Colonel Attalas. If the mere fact that Congress has said you can, as a victim, you can go to the CCA, why does that necessarily mean you can't vindicate your rights at the trial court level?
Your Honor, because Article 6B4, read in context with the remaining rights that are also within Article 6B and brought in through the military rules of evidence, do not provide standing. Congress has been very clear, and so has the President, when victims are provided standing. MRE 412, 513, 514, they've brought in 615 as well. And all of these concepts linked to when a named victim has standing. Congress and the President have made it very clear.
So silence on a point equates to clarity?
In this case, with constructing Article 6BA9, Your Honor, yes, Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes. That's essentially...
Congress doesn't typically use the word right, that a person has a right.
That's true, Your Honor, but again, that right, if interpreted the way that appellant is suggesting, consumes the rest of Article 6B.
So what is the real-world harm? What is the problem if you're saying, oh, it consumes the rest of the rule, we have this parade of imaginary horribles. All that the victim is asking for is the right to be heard, to have their written submission considered by a military judge. Why are we going to make this extreme ruling based on silence when the real world harm is minimal, negligible?
Your Honor, I disagree that the real world harm is minimal or negligible, because ultimately, if anything can encompass Article 6BA9, anything can then come and become a request for a writ. So, for example, here,
yeah, give me some examples. What are you talking about? What's this? The doors open wide. What's coming through the door?
Your Honor, it could be anything from not being able to discuss with trial counsel. A member should be voir dired and removed from a panel. It could be, in this case, that medical records that are clearly covered by RCM 701 are covered by some other statute or provision of the law. It could be that the military judge looked funny at the named victim and therefore...
But anybody can file all sorts of different legal actions in a court.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that's the point, is because Congress has created this mechanism...
This right...
A mechanism in Article 6BE that says this is how victims can assume to enforce their rights. This is how they're going to do it.
Why does that make sense? And again, I've gone through this. So a military judge doesn't develop the record, doesn't get engaged in this, doesn't make any reviewable ruling. It goes up to the CCA. What do they have to do? Send it back down and say, develop the record? Doesn't it make much more sense to view this as meaning Congress said, we want to make it clear that CCA can get involved in here also? The typical procedures are still in place where a military judge develops a record, makes a ruling, and that's, we're making clear, it then can go up to the CCA.
That's what the statute says, Your Honor, with regards to how a victim can enforce her right. I know that I am simply repeating myself when it comes to that, but as the government pointed out up here, that the Crime Victims' Rights Act and Article 6B have different mechanisms for enforcing rights. Congress, for whatever reason, and this court doesn't need to speculate, but for whatever reason did not include the same enforcement mechanism at the trial level for enforcement of these rights that they've then created. And ultimately, it comes down to what Congress decided and the written word is law in this case. I mean, from as recently as United States versus Brown, this court held that we don't read in extra textual considerations. And I know Your Honor disagrees with that the law is ambiguous or clear, but here it is clear. When there are different mechanisms embedded into Article 6B, Article 6B4 specifically, and other mechanisms throughout the law, like the military rules of evidence, that allow that standing, Congress did not include the same standing for all of the rights. It is different, and statutes must be read in context in order to determine what they mean.
Captain, it's clear you're not going to be able to change the Chief Judge's mind, so can I move to a different topic here? On the issue of whether or not, on the issue of the fact that of the judge starting in 701, now, I think in this case, he issued an order to have trial counsel go get this stuff and determine whether it's privileged or not, I think. At least take a first shot at it, did he not? I can't remember the nature of the order, but I thought that's what it said.
Yes, Your Honor. So the order specifically states that it's trial counsel's obligation to go and obtain these records, but then provides an additional order to, quote, facilitate the disclosure of those records. And that order is what which is assists in the removal of privileged material, any possible
privileged
material. Right.
But, I mean, so under this framework, under 701, it's the trial counsel making the first determination on what is privilege and what is not. And it seems important to me, especially in Millett, since the court decided in Millett that, yeah, this kind of information or these records are presumed or generally not privileged, but they could be, right? And so I would imagine that the privilege holder would have a problem with someone other than the military judge determining in the first instance, what is privileged and what is not. Wouldn't they? Wouldn't you agree with that?
Your Honor, I understand your question now with regards to the language and the order you're referring to. So to clarify, I don't agree that it's trial counsel first determining what records or what material in those records are privileged. The order specifically provided that trial counsel would obtain the records but maintain a privilege log for what was not released. That information was not intended or ordered to go to trial counsel in any way. This is comparable to if any other sort of material like attorney work product or attorney-client privilege documents that someone's asserting a privilege and trial counsel says, I can't provide this in discovery because someone has asserted a privilege. I have to make a privilege log in alignment with either the defense counsel request, which is often seen in these discovery requests, or with the military judge's order.
But once, it seems to me in your conversation with the chief judge, you're still sticking to the position that on, as long as you're in 701, there simply is no standing under that rule, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But if the military judge makes the first call on what is privilege and what is not, and then goes to the parties and says, here is my decision, isn't that what now casts the situation into one of the situations governed by 6B? It's a ruling that definitely affects the privilege holder. The privilege holder may not agree with the military judge and would like to be heard on why he or she thinks the information is or is not privileged.
Your Honor, based on...
Isn't that the way it should work?
Yes, Your Honor. If the military judge invokes, for example, RCM 703 or 513 in a ruling about discovery, which is what is at issue here in this case?
Well, I'm going back further than that. I mean, the order, again, it goes to my, complaint, because I am kind of whining up here about this, but it goes back to my point where the initial discovery request comes in from the defense asking for Millett material under 701, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it seems to me that therein lies some of the problem, because 701, I mean, it sounds like everyone is using 701 to treat this information just like it's some other kind of discoverable document in possession of the government. But Millett, and fairly subtly, and the dissent more directly, I think, suggested that that this stuff might not always be privileged. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree with up until we get to the point that there's a ruling. Because if we look at RCM 701, if this dispute between the government and defense did not exist, meaning the parties, agreed on what was discoverable, we would not be here, ultimately. Because how we get here is through an invocation or a reading of Article 6B(a)(9).
And my point is that if at the very outset the military judge decides this Millett material is a little different than what is normally discoverable or not discoverable, therefore I'm going to treat it maybe even presumptively privileged. And it might turn out to be non-privileged, and then over to the defense it goes. But wouldn't that have kind of obviated all of these problems? Because at that point, You'd have to agree that the privilege holder would have standing, wouldn't you?
I would agree that if the military judge said, we're going to operate that Millett matters fall under MRE 513 or some other provision of discovery, that changes the landscape. But speaking from a defense perspective, the defense might argue that this raises our burden and changes the law and is an improper interpretation. Thus, that could be reviewed ultimately for error. And since there is nothing in the rules for courts.
Well, I'm not saying the judge has to go right to 513. I'm saying the judge should make an assessment, or I'm asking you whether the judge should make an assessment in determining whether or not I ought to start in a different place because of how the court has characterized this kind of evidence.
No, Your Honor. The rules are clear that if this is a military authority, this goes back to kind of what the government was saying, that if we're in RCM 701 world, there are clear guidelines of how to produce discovery in that realm or disclose.
Counsel, I guess, didn't the victim have a right to seek as soon as her medical records became at issue, didn't she have a right to seek an interlocutory ruling from the military judge? Didn't 513E1 give her standing right at that moment? We can parse 6B9A9 and decide what the right to be treated fairly means. But does it matter? Can't we go straight to 513E1?
No, Your Honor. We disagree with how this court was talking about the application of
Tell me when we get off track. In any case in which the production or admission of records or communications of a patient other than the accused is a matter in dispute, a party may seek an interlocutory ruling by the military judge.
Yes, Your Honor. I think based on the fact that the...
So weren't her the production of her medical records in dispute?
Yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't that mean that any party right at that moment could have sought an interlocutory ruling from the military judge?
No, Your Honor, because under 513, based on this court's ruling in Millett, is that this phrase, essentially, records or communication of a patient, has become now a specific or a legal term of art. That would be our position, essentially, if 513 was invoked or...
513 was about the scope of the privilege, right? And some medical records my interpretation of Millett is that some medical records might be privileged and some might not be. And I thought the opinion was pretty clear that that was the case. And just because a medical record was not privileged didn't necessarily mean that it was admissible. It might not be relevant. There could be, I think we were pretty clear, maybe not clear enough, I guess, that all of the rules of evidence still applied. And just because it wasn't protected by the 513 privilege, that didn't mean it was automatically admissible. And there's a procedure in 513E1 that, at least in my reading, says any time a patient's medical records are in dispute, that any party can seek an interlocutory ruling from the military judge. Right? So what am I missing when I look at that and I say the moment the defense sought the production of her medical records, that she had, everyone had, the right under 513E1 to seek an interlocutory ruling from the military judge about whether or not they'd be produced?
Your Honor, based on how the privilege has been construed or narrowed by Millett, the position is essentially that this term of art that's incorporated throughout Military Rule of Evidence 513 is about what is privileged, not just any medical record. And I think that's a fundamental disagreement of when or why 513E would apply or not. With regards to this case, though, it's very clear that what defense was asking for at the trial level was non-privileged medical matters. And if the reading is that 513 should have been applied in that case, then yes, Your Honor, there should have been more available. And, Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Castagne.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Bunnell.
Thank you, Your Honor. On rebuttal, I want to first address something that Judge Hardy asked the government, and that is Article 6B, Subsection A, Paragraph 4, talking about standing or something else? Our position is that it's clearly something else. Nowhere in Section 4 does it say that the victim has the right to object if their right to allocute is violated. It's talking about the list in Article 6BA is a bill of substantive rights. It says nothing about the process for the victim to object. And the Air Force Court in HK really conflated these two. They saw the words right to be heard, and they assumed they were talking about standing. Section 4 has nothing to do with standing. In fact, let's say, for example, that right was violated, that the victim wanted to put in an impact statement, didn't get the opportunity to do that. Where does it say anything in Section 4 about the right standing to object? It doesn't talk about that at all. They've conflated the two. And so,
But counsel, I agree with you. Neither one of these expressly grants standing. Isn't the right to be heard in a trial closer to standing than the right to be treated fairly? Like, is this a good argument for you? Or do you think that the right to be treated fairly demands the right to participate, to have grant standing to participate in the trial?
Well, what I mean to say is there's an argument about exclusio unius or whatever it is, right? The construction saying it's not expressly said. And I'm saying that argument doesn't make sense. What I'm saying is the rights themselves create the standing. There's a concomitant right to be heard if you want to have it redressed, and that's paired out in subsection E where it says a trial court ruling. And all you have to do is think about this case in those terms. Let's say the MTF did not turn over those records. Instead of saying no to the government, they said, oh, you want these records? Have at it. Here are all these records.
Counsel, what is your response to my question to the other counsel that 513E1 granted the victim in this case, as soon as her medical records became at issue, the right to, and therefore I think standing, obviously, to seek an interlocutory ruling?
We have no problem with that. That's one of the reasons that we'd have standing. If that didn't exist, I don't think.
Isn't that a much more explicit reading than trying to parse what the right to be treated fairly means in Article 6B? Like, isn't 513 a concrete, definitive application of, say, the right to be treated fairly?
Absolutely. But again, we're just saying we don't, that's great. We're already, it's a low-hanging fruit. We can get through it that way. But when we look at Article 6B subsection E itself, what it's saying is there has to be a court-martial ruling. And our point is if victims don't get heard at the trial level, there will never be a ruling. And so the rights themselves, the concomitant right, and this is, again, Marbury versus Madison, the concomitant right is you have to be able to redress it. And if we can't take it to the trial level, we can't take it to the CCA. We can't get any sort of remedy. And so that.
Now here, the victim didn't seek an interlocutory order about the production of her medical records, right? Because am I remembering? If I'm misremembering the record, please correct me.
So what happened in the record is they got notice, the victim got notice, that government was producing these records and that they had some discussion. The victim filed something with the court ignored it completely, and then in a footnote said, I didn't consider these things. And so we tried.
Did that submission to the courts ask for a remedy?
Yes, we asked for these to be, first of all, analyzed under 703. We asked them not to be disclosed without, you know, especially the medical records without a 513 hearing, all that stuff.
I mean, is it reasonable to say that she was seeking an interlocutory order from the military judge about the production of her medical records?
Absolutely. I do want to talk, if not opening a can of worms, I want to go back to military authorities and Judge Johnson's questions here. And I want to make my position really clear. What I'm saying textually about that phrase, military authorities, is if you look at how that is deployed throughout the MCM, all 20 times, it's used to describe those that are involved in the case. And if you look at the counterpart, you've got military authorities on one hand, and you have civilian authorities on the other hand. And that phrase is used throughout the MCM as well. Always, invariably, that term is used to describe civilian authorities that have something to do with crime, with criminal law, right? With law and order. They're involved in the case. And so this court's opinion in Stellato, I think, is incredibly helpful. Right? In Stellato, this court used the phrase prosecution team, which Judge Stuckey points out in his concurrence, it's military authorities. But I think it's actually a really good phrase to say, hey, look, we're not just talking about the prosecutor's office. We're not just talking about law enforcement. It can be the polygrapher, as was the case in Simmons. It can be the convening authority. It can be the first sergeant. If the first sergeant puts on their investigation hat, that those things can all be military authorities. I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Further questions?
Could you indulge?
Absolutely.
All right, given what you just said regarding that question on this military authorities, if we agree that the military judge can use his authority or her authority under 701G to regulate discovery, does it matter whether or not the records are kept in a military treatment facility? I mean, the military judge can simply issue an order to the facility in compliance with, say, the DOD manual and whatever other requirements, and be done with it.
Well, I guess what we're trying to ensure is that the strictures in 703, where it triggers the victim's right to be heard, that stuff still, as long as that is triggered, really, that's our grievance, right? We're not.
Let's assume that's the case. That does trigger. The military judges decide to take a process that does, in fact, trigger the privilege holder's right to be heard. Does it really matter whether or not it's in a military treatment facility or whether it's in the hands of military authorities?
It's a fair question. I think ultimately what it'll be is, is the motion to quash analysis that's embedded in 703 also going to be given to the victim in that case? Because then they have to show unreasonable and impressible. We got the Nixon factors, all these other things that we have to consider. If their right to be heard includes all of that process as well, potentially. But at the end of the day, the finding that military authorities or the MTF, it's a problem. Because then everybody in the military is an MTF, or I'm sorry, is a military authority. And not say nothing of the Brady obligations that the government's incurring. The victim herself, like, is her cell phone? She's a military authority? Okay, is not in this case, but presumably in some cases victims are active duty. Maybe they have some responsibilities. Are all of their personal things that are housed on base, are those now in the possession of military authorities?
Right, well, that would be a little bit extended, but I think you've answered my question.
Thank you kindly, Your Honor.
Further questions?
Yes, Chief, I was going to follow up to Judge Hardy's question about instead of doing all these gymnastics, wouldn't just the reading of 513E1 just cut to the chase? It's medical records that triggers the right. You, as you just said, what you're looking for is the triggering of a right. And so that could trigger the right.
It could. Our only concern with that, and we're happy that is out there and available to us, but what we're concerned about is the hypothetical that I was putting forward earlier. What happens when they want to go into the courtroom and they're not allowed to? If we don't establish that they're standing to object to the Article 6B rights, then we're going to be back here again and again and again every time that comes up until that question's answered.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Major Bunnell. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for all sides, and we will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.